I mean, this isn't. Do you remember any more of the debate at that time? You know, just before you left Vietnam, you were just saying that, you know, when they saw these weapons, that it seemed convincing to a lot of IVSers that maybe they were living in a country that was being invaded.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that this isn't a civil war, and that maybe we're, you know, maybe this is a macro problem.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of that debate going on, and I think it was hard. I think our perspective living there was probably more limited than if we'd been living here, because we weren't seeing the war on television. We weren't. I know. I felt, even though I'm a person from a peace church and doing alternate service to the draft, I continually made excuses for what was going on there, because of feeling a loyalty and a closeness to Vietnamese people that seemed to want our help. And I felt that too much emphasis, well, all the time we felt too much emphasis was given on to the military side when, for instance, when we first lived in Baloch and it was secure and we could live there and drive, it was very difficult to find funding to do extra projects there, because money was going to insecure provinces.
Mm-hmm.
If they were being threatened, then the money went there to keep the Viet Cong from making inroads, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the places that were secure, that people could work and do work in education and development projects, the funding wasn't available. And it seemed strange that then all of a sudden, when it came to fighting, you know, it's available for planes and weapons and all the rest of it.
Well,
but not for the development side of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that the civilian side of what was going on there was constructive and was important, and we see now that it did help people, that it wasn't just a colonial action,
mm-hmm.
although I can see how people call it that,
mm-hmm.
you know. It was people still are hospitable to Americans there. You go there now.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew the difference, and they know now the difference between Americans that were there out of a heartfelt interest in helping them improve their agriculture, improve their education, and improve their medical care. Compared to the American policies and the escalation of the war, but it was just that, and it happened after I left, the destructive side became so much more overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that was when IVSers were killed. And it was difficult to differentiate between being a civilian American and being part of the American team.
Well, since we're about to leave Vietnam for Laos.
Yeah.
Trying to look at the deaths in both countries in a kind of comparative perspective later.
Mm-hmm.
But in Vietnam, with the exception of David, what kind of, did it appear to you that people who were killed in Vietnam were largely killed by accident or because of bad timing rather than being targeted?
At the time,
yeah.
I thought it was by accident and timing and that they were Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I've learned since, it sounds like they were targeted. But because I wasn't there as much a part of it, and also I lived in cities more than really in the countryside, where many IVSers were in rural areas where I didn't speak Vietnamese fluently.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke enough Vietnamese to go to the market and to, you know, carry on average conversations.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time I was with people trying to learn English, and they wanted to speak English.
Mm-hmm.
So the IVSers that were really in the countryside and really spoke fluent Vietnamese, I think, had a much better understanding, where I was kind of once removed
mm-hmm.
from. It's like I thought that they were probably in the wrong place at the wrong time, but then I was at the memorial in Washington, D.C. at the 30th anniversary, and they put up a wall of all the people who were killed, their interests, you know, something about them, and then people spoke about them personally.
For the and about people who were not in the armed services who were killed in Vietnam.
This was all IVS reunion.
Oh, it's an IVS
reunion? It was an IVS reunion, and it was just put up as big. We did our own thing with big pieces of paper that had the person's name. When they applied for IVS, they put, like, their favorite books, some personal things about them, and then how they were killed. And it was there that I was shocked to learn. I think it was there that I first really mourned their deaths. In the case of Marty Klisch, he was shot down in a helicopter in Laos. He was probably the person I knew best. And
but then he was just in a helicopter.
He was in a helicopter that was shot down. So it wasn't something that where he was targeted directly. But what I learned about the others was it definitely sounded like they were targeted. They were people who were talking about problems that people didn't want them to talk about.
Well, just for the fun of it, so we have plenty of tape, and there's no reason why we can't. But let's leave Laos to one side for a moment.
Yeah.
And just about Vietnam.
Yeah.
Was it Peter who was killed on a Vespa? There was one volunteer driving a Vespa who passed an armored column and ran right into an ambush that was set up for the armored column.
Oh, yeah, so that would have been an
accident. That
would
have been an accident.
Yeah.
David, we know that there's a continuing controversy over. But we could talk about David right here, just briefly. David Gittleson was an IVSer who was killed just prior to the Tet Offensive and in 1968. And you were in Laos.
I was in Laos.
Did you hear anything about
him? I met his parents afterwards. Just what I heard at this reunion, and then an article was sent to me by someone who had researched it further. And I was here at a reunion with some people who were there and knew him, and had been there when Ted Kennedy came and was talking to refugees. And they were telling him what was happening with the refugee resettlement and problems with that. But the article, and what I had heard about David was that he was talking about things the Vietnamese didn't want. First, I just thought, well, he was killed by Viet Cong. That was what the story was.
Right.
And then it became evident that it wasn't, that it may have been ARVN, the Vietnamese military. But the latest article that was sent me was that somebody had researched saying it was a part of the Phoenix program, and actually saying it was Americans that had eliminated him because of his speaking being making it problematic for what they were doing, and because of what he had learned living in the villages. So that's why the continuing mystery. I don't know the answer, but I know that people are still researching and trying to find answers.
What about, are there any other IVSers who were killed that you even heard of the circumstance or the event? In Vietnam.
In Vietnam. You were talking about Peter Hunting being just caught in an ambush, I think. There was someone else in a vehicle that I heard, but I don't remember who it was, but that I heard about. That something to do with the Koreans.
Oh, that's right. Actually was killed in an accident with a Korean truck.
Yeah.
And the Koreans were well known. It was in Trong, I think.
Yeah.
But they were well known for driving way too fast.
Yeah.
And had injured lots of Vietnamese with their practices.
Yeah.
And he just, bad timing.
Yeah.
So to speak,
yeah.
But not enemy action.
Yeah.
And the IVSers who were taken as captives during the Tet Offensive in Hue, they were released.
The woman was released.
Uh-huh.
I know her story because my friend Anne was her roommate. She was released. She was captured with a Quaker woman doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And they were released, but the others spent 5 years in prisons in the North before. And we have books and writings from them. And I think that IVS helped get funding for them as payment during the years they were in prison. One was actually Canadian, not American.
Right.
And they would be important people to interview for this history because they certainly had extraordinary experiences. And from what I heard, I've met them both because I was involved in the board when they came back.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard other former POWs speak. And these two men were just exceptional in their attitude and their acceptance of their experience.
Mm-hmm.
And finding it as a time for personal growth and not saying they understood because IVS was headquartered in Washington and obviously they would be considered part of the war effort. Especially for the Canadian, I think it was amazing that he had the attitude. I think the hardest thing they said was not having communication outside and people not knowing. Don Luce did quite a bit to find out about their circumstances and make sure they were okay.
Mm-hmm. Which brings us to Laos.
Yes.
And so you left Hong Kong. In the spring of 1965.
Mm-hmm, I think it was April.
And in April. And you flew to Laos. And when you arrived in Laos, did you feel you were in a different place than Vietnam or Cambodia?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And also, Laos was a neutral country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could really work on rural development and community programs here without having the conflict going on around us like... like was in Vietnam.
How long until you realized that wasn't quite as true as it first occurred? Or at least for the whole country.
Yeah. It was really interesting because when we went there, I was having personal problems because I had not had a period. And I went to doctors in Hong Kong. I went to doctors, I don't know how many, 4 or 5. And they just said not to worry because of the evacuation and all the changes in my life. I probably just am, you know, having some upset. Well, I got off we had some Lao language training and assistants assigned us. And then we're told that they would like us to work in rural development rather than teaching. And that we would open up a rural program south of Ta Kek in southern Laos. On our way, we would meet the area coordinator in Savannakhet. So we flew into Savannakhet. I got off the plane and threw up, and I never get airsick. And that my friend Penny that's coming from Laos says that's what she remembers seeing me. That was her first sight of me, was getting off the plane and throwing up.
Right.
It was a bumpy flight, and there was a lot of garlic on it. It was one of those kind of cargo planes where you sit on the side, and there was a bunch of garlic in the middle. So I had plenty of excuses, you know, for being airsick. But didn't find out until somewhat later that I was pregnant with Andrea. And so while we were in Savannakhet, this person told us that the area we would be opening, south of Ta Kek, was Vietnamese, a lot of Vietnamese speaking. And what they wanted to know was whether or not they were... it seemed like there was loyalty to Ho Chi Minh because they had pictures of Ho Chi Minh in their houses. And they suspected that there was some people going through this area to Thailand, where there were Vietnamese in northeast Thailand. And they told us that they were going to build an airstrip. They were building a road, they needed to build a bridge, but we would move down by boat and find a place to live, and we would have a radio. And there would be two armies there. There would be a Lao army, and there would be another army. And we might see other Americans there, but don't ask them any questions. And they said that in Laos, we were to live from the commissary. You know, where in Vietnam we live in the economy you know, with everyone else. They said the experience had been there that if Americans, if you're living in a rural area and your diet was fulfilled, it would upset the economy. So they preferred us to order everything from Vientiane and have it flown in to Ta Kek, carry it down by river. So we made a couple of trips down, once by jeep and once by river, and found the house, and we're getting that set up. And, what they told us about the two armies, that one would have radios, and if anything happened, that the Lao army would probably disappear, but the other one would be there. And we would have a radio, and they would make one part of the road wide so it would be an airstrip, so that if we needed to be evacuated, we could be. Mm-hmm. Well, this sort of didn't sound very secure. But we were willing to go along with it. We thought it would be a wonderful experience, and we liked all the people that we met there, and we seemed to be welcomed. And in this area, Val Peterson was the USAID person. I think, was he USAID or still IVSN? I don't know. You can ask Val, but he was in Ta Kek. And so while this was being arranged, and we each had, I had a Lao counterpart that I would be working with in nutrition and health, public health education. And very basic. And so my stomach problems continued in the mornings. And while we were in, there was a road crew on the building a road between Ta Kek and Vientiane. Our first thing there, we met the king, the prime minister, and the ambassador on the road. Dedication. And we met a doctor there, a German doctor, who was then hired by the clinic in Vientiane. Mm-hmm. And he taught somebody how to do a pregnancy test and told me about 3-4 months later that I was pregnant. And so then it was, what should we do? And IVS's policy when we joined had been to take a 3-month leave and then go back to work. We wrote some things arguing that, because of course in the village the first thing people ask, well, how long have you been married? Well, how come you don't have any kids? And so I felt not really being, how, you know, still being naive, I thought, this is a wonderful place to live. I have all the food from the commissary. There were British doctors there, Colombo Plan doctors in Ta Kek. I thought, why not have family here? Because if you're going to be teaching child nutrition, what better way than to be, you know, taking care of your own child? How much more
bonding
yes. and influence you could have with other families right. if you had, you know, a child. And we made a real good case for it, but at that time they said, IVS just said, no, we'll just terminate you in September, the end of your 2 years. And of course, Andrea was due in December, and that left us, well, where are we going to go? In the meantime, the director from Cambodia, the education person there, was in Laos at the teacher training college where IVS English teachers were, and we could have been transferred over to the education team and live in the capital. Mm-hmm. But as it worked out, he was hiring people on USAID contracts. So after all our lobbying, we ended our time with IVS after the 2 years, mm-hmm. and then Ron started the USAID contract teaching at the teacher training college at Don Dok mm-hmm. with IVSers and other former Peace Corps mm-hmm. from Thailand who were doing basically IVS jobs. Mm-hmm. And then I was free to be housewife and mother. Mm-hmm. What they didn't want, the reason that I could not be employed and have a child was that I couldn't work the 8-hour days and right. do the monthly reports and all of this. So then what AID did was hire families. Some of them were former IVS Vietnam families and put them out into rural areas. And
the whole family?
The whole family with the kids. They bought my argument that you could be
USAID
more effective.
USAID did.
USAID bought uh-huh. the argument uh-huh. that you could be more effective uh-huh. with a family. But the wives couldn't work. The husband was employed.
Stay at home in these small villages.
Yeah, right. But there's some really good articles. I think one couple wrote a story that was in Reader's Digest about their experiences in the countryside. There's the Polings were south of. They were maybe in provincial capitals, but they, anyway, they did send families, and it wasn't always safe. It wasn't a good idea. But I didn't realize the level of insecurity at all. And I still, when we moved to Vientiane and lived there, I said we ended up staying there 5 years.
From April of 65 to
No, 19. From, yeah, from April to, right. April to almost September, we were in Takek,
in the
south.
That's right.
And then we went up to Vientiane.
Right.
Then we went home on our IVS thing, so I came home just barely. I could just fly. I mean, it was just under the timeline that I flew back, and then Andrew was born in Bangkok. And then I taught English and taught fourth grade at the American school
in
Vientiane. And then we were from USAID contract went to Lao American Association, where Ron was director of activities.
Lao American Association, what was that?
It was the binational center under USIS. And I also coordinated the AFS students, you know, the high school American students actually came. And found Lao families for them to stay with. I learned more about Lao families and Lao culture from them than I do.
From the AFS?
From the AFS kids, yeah. What else did I do? I got involved with the women's club. Because they, I found out, well, one of the things that I really realized after leaving IVS is that IVS is the biggest, was the biggest bargain program the government had, because we did live simply and we lived without all the expectations, except for our arrival in Cambodia when we were expected to sort of fit in with the diplomatic circles there, at least initially, in introductions. In the other countries, we just lived totally different than other Americans lived. We didn't have air conditioning, we didn't have vehicles. We, in Vietnam, lived on the economy. Sometimes we found ourselves being the recipients of handouts. You know, like the military used to give us their leftover steaks, you know, our doggy bag from their steak nights. We would be offered goodies from the commissary from, you know, other families. But once you're government employee, then you're expected to entertain and have, you know, stock your liquor cabinet and, you know, the whole the whole thing.
Well, the pay would be different, too. You were only earning, about $70 a month? Or?
In the bank here, yeah. Yeah. And I don't ever remember being deprived or anything. It was fine. But the amount of money once you're government hired and the facilities that you have and the shipping allowance and everything else is just
another level. Yes.
It's just incredible. And so that's one of the reasons why I dedicated myself to supporting IVS all these years, I think, is because I felt like it's programs like this that are really the most beneficial. I also didn't understand that under U.S. law, the government is mandated to supply all this for Americans working overseas, which was why Kilometer 6 was built like it was, to provide housing and water and safety. That was the American compound outside of Vientiane, Laos, where Americans were housed. At the time, I thought maybe it's because they wanted to isolate some of the community activities from being a part of the local. Because we always lived locally in Vientiane. But for the most part, the American community was isolated and lived apart and knew very little about what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Is this where
what life was like?
Galen's green building was? The one that he always said that was a spook headquarters? Was that a kilometer six?
No, that one was in the Nahidio, that you say compound.
Yes.
In town.
In town, okay.
Yeah.
And after you spent five years then as a kind of, as a dependent.
A dependent and then employee of the American school.
And the employee of the American school.
Yeah.
And did you notice in those 5 years, I mean, obviously these are five very tumultuous years in Laos. How did you perceive that? Well, let's focus in for the moment on one big moment. There's only, of those 5 years, there's only one time, I guess it was August of 69, where there was a meeting of IVS and USAID personnel that Fred Branfman is concerned with,
mm-hmm.
and which you must have had a copy of the letter he wrote to Don Luce,
yeah.
asking about what
yeah.
we were doing and
yeah.
stuff like that.
Yeah.
And did you, Galen remembers that
yeah.
very well. Fortunately,
yeah.
he
yeah.
made a record of it
yeah, he has
before
the
meeting.
Yeah.
So he
I
has
think
his,
that
yeah.
we met with Galen
uh-huh.
and a few former IVS, because quite a few former IVSers were there.
Right.
A lot from our team, and one of the couples from Cambodia got married, Phil
mm-hmm.
and Joanne Bushler,
mm-hmm.
married later in Laos and were there till 75. And yeah, so I think a lot of the former volunteers there had input. I wasn't at the meeting,
mm-hmm.
but had some input there. And I think at the time, I believed in the IVS role, but I believed Laos was basically neutral. I really didn't have any concept how widespread the bombing was that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Although we had friends from Samtong, another couple from Laverne, Gary and Brenda Peters.
Mm-hmm.
She was a nurse, and he ran a radio up there. They wouldn't tell us what was going on, but once in a while they'd come and stay with us.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that they were getting out of some kind of insecure situation,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't press either to find out, you know, what was going on up there. I knew Fred, too,
mm-hmm.
and I heard... later years, see, we left in 70, so I heard in the later years from him. And I didn't know the extent of what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I think, now I wish I had listened more. Also, there was another reporter there, Tim Allman, T.D. Allman, that I think he still is writing out of New York, you know of him?
Mm-mm.
That was writing a lot and had gotten into some
oh,
areas.
Yes, in actual fact, I do. I have seen a byline of his and some research I did a long time ago.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Recently, he did something extensive on Sihanouk.
Mm-hmm.
So I know he's
Bob
still writing.
Anson, Bob Anson did an incredible piece in the New York Times Magazine on Sihanouk
uh-huh.
that was just spot on. It was really
uh-huh.
good stuff.
Yeah.
But
so
yeah.
he was there, so I knew from him, and my ex-husband probably knew more. I was really occupied with
mm-hmm.
a toddler
mm-hmm.
and was friends with a lot of the other women with young children. And I had quite a few Lao friends. But in Vientiane, you know, my friends were upper-class women. They weren't
mm-hmm.
Village women.
Mm-hmm.
And I really have learned more here through my work with Laylee Haislip about the struggle of the village women, both in Vietnam and Laos.
So if someone said forward area team to you, would it have meant anything to you in those days?
I knew what it was.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, what was it from your impression?
From my impression, a forward area team was a team somewhat like we were going to Nong Bok
uh-huh.
that was working with villagers in an area that was potentially insecure to connect this area to the central Lao government because Laos the communication in the country with the central government. Central government was very isolated. And people could live in remote areas and be living anywhere. That they're near Thailand, they'll be relating to the Thais across the river, but maybe not to central government. Mm-hmm. One of the things they did with us in this Phnom Bok experience, we went out by helicopter. I remember this because the guy was using baling wire on it, one of those big green ones, to schools that they had promised materials to the for repairing or building schools in this area. And they wanted it known, they wanted the people to have this connection with central government helping them. Mm-hmm. So they would have loyalty to the central, to the Royal Lao government. Mm-hmm. And have build, there were nation building. Mm-hmm. And there were leaflets flown, dropped, mm-hmm. we were told, saying that yes, these materials have arrived, and we went out with the helicopter. Was building roads so there could be better communication. Mm-hmm. People to have transportation for marketing agriculture products and mm-hmm. for development. Mm-hmm. And
was it your perception? See, the problem is that when Fred talks about Laos, he's of an activist bent.
Yeah.
Who quickly got into the country.
Yeah.
Didn't have any great commitments. Had plenty of time to apply his political energy to what was happening.
Yeah.
And he absorbed these things very quickly.
Yeah.
And came to very quick conclusions.
Yeah.
And generalizations, all of which I think are quite accurate from
yeah.
his perspective. It appears to me, however, that very few people had that perspective because they didn't have his focus.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that Fred is so wrong, but it's not part of the same reality
yeah.
for most people. And what I'm trying to get to, and I'll talk to Ron about this in particular, is if you're involved in a country where the central government is trying to gain the loyalty of its people
yeah.
through nation building, that's what Lyndon Johnson would be doing with the Great Society.
Yeah.
The difference is there isn't a rival political movement which is also seeking the loyalty of those people.
Yeah.
Well, there is now in Montana,
yeah.
but
yeah.
the idea
yeah.
is that
yeah.
there isn't a rival group. So I guess to try to pin down your feelings,
yeah.
when you think of the Royal Lao government,
yeah.
what are you thinking about those other people? How do those other people,
well,
how do the Pathet Lao, what are they, a rival political party?
Okay.
Are they people fomenting unrest?
Well,
Howard calls them the bad guys, but
yeah.
that's after
yeah.
a lot of USAID experience.
I guess to me, I believed... No, I didn't believe it. But, you know, they were supposed to have a coalition government.
Mm-hmm.
They were supposed to be the leftists and the centrists and the rightists mm-hmm. forming a government together. And I didn't really understand. I understand more now mm-hmm. about the rivalries that involved in this and how impossible it really was. But I didn't understand the politics of it. I was not sophisticated
mm-hmm.
in terms of politics, being from a Brethren background, you know, politics is terrible and bad, and you know, all that, and I didn't have a background in political science, and really not a very good background. We just had to self-educate ourselves in Asian history because our liberal arts education was very much tilted towards Western European history, not Asian history, and. I didn't know, well, one of the things we knew it was corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
We knew there were more Mercedes-Benzes in Vientiane than probably any other developing country.
Mm-hmm.
We knew all this, you know, and we knew that, and we could see the living standard was, when I was in Hong Kong, before I went to Laos, one of the women there said, oh, if you're going to Laos, you know, that's the crotch of the universe. That's the last place. There's only two paved roads in this capital of this country you're going to. I mean, she really made it sound like the pits, you know. And it was much less developed than either Cambodia or Vietnam. Then the people were great, and not that, you know, everyone always said Bopinyang, which means doesn't matter, never mind, made Manana sound like a rat race because things there move very, very slowly. And what happened then, I understand people are worried about happening again, is that because Lao were not trained and did not, about the average education in the National Assembly was fifth grade. In order to get things done expediently, USAID brought in third country nationals. They brought in a lot of Thais, a lot of Filipinos, because they just viewed Lao as incapable of performing a lot of the services and jobs, and most of the mechanics were Vietnamese. Most of the households that had hired cooks, they were Vietnamese or Chinese. They were not Lao. It was rumored that there had been a United Nations study, but because of the sticky rice diet that Lao had, a retarded
a lower
condition,
IQ.
A lower IQ, and there was not a very good attitude about Lao. And I felt that it wasn't fair that Lao are just uniquely blessed with their insights and abilities and I enjoyed the culture, I enjoyed the lifestyle, and felt like Vientiane. Well, I had friends there who were, you know, Russian, Israeli, Indian, because everybody was there, and you socialized with all these different nationalities there. In fact, you know, we joked about going shopping with the Path at Lao because their headquarters were right by the morning market. And people would tell me, too, and I have the feeling that the Lao didn't really like fighting very much, and that they would rather switch sides than fight. In fact, there was a story about a coup that happened before we were there where they changed scarves so they didn't have to confront each other. And I don't know if you're getting some of that from people in the countryside, but I just felt like they were unfortunately caught in the middle of all the conflict. And I've seen a documentary about Hmong that they were forced to take sides too, where most of the people would rather have lived without becoming involved in one side or the other. But not knowing, you know, the politics of it, I didn't know the extent of the American operation in the fields, and that there were American military. I knew there was CIA, and they told us in Tak Ek there were people coming across the river that just don't ask them any questions. They're over here working. And the CIA was a joke in Vietnam in a sense that we knew they were flying into areas and paying Vietnamese for information that we thought, that's silly, why don't they just ask somebody that lives here instead of paying for information. But all this hindsight. When I was living there, except for the flood, there were three crises. The flood in 66. It must have been 66, because Andrea wasn't a year. Yeah, she was 8 months old then, so it was the fall of 66. We were evacuated in the middle of the night. Just go, don't ask any questions. We didn't want to go. We thought where we lived wasn't going to be flooded. It's a little community called Leeville. But we had to go by truck out to kilometer 6 to be out there in case they had to evacuate everyone. And then the other thing, when General Ma bombed Strafe Vientiane, I was in a house right in town, walked out the back door and looked up and saw, I heard the windows rattling, and I thought, that's strange, you know, the enemy doesn't have bombs. I mean, planes, we don't have to worry about them bombing. You know, what is this, planes breaking the sound barrier going over from Thailand, or what is this? And I walked out the back door with Andrew in my arms and watched the planes come down and strafe and bomb just a few blocks over from us. And I thought, what in the world is going on here? And that was the first really taste of what I must be like for the people who've been under all this bombing. And that was the one of General Ma's coup attempts that he bombed Vientiane. But other than that, life in Vientiane was very quiet.
Would you say that other than those two events and the big meeting of 1969, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to provide a kind of framework. Life in Laos was a neutral country. Things every day was just like every other day for most people. In the northern part of the country.
It was a war zone.
But it was a no-go area where you weren't supposed to ask questions. You weren't even supposed to write home.
And you weren't supposed to talk to anybody in Vientiane.
This
is what I got more and more and more was, this was a, nobody could talk about it. Because I knew the Weldons. And I met Pop Buell several times, and we knew that they were in that, from that zone, that something was going on, we don't talk about it. And then my other friend was a nurse up in the hospital there. She was terrified to talk about it. She's told me a lot about it since. Yeah, and I felt, too, a loyalty that obviously Fred didn't feel. Because we'd signed things, you know, saying we wouldn't write or talk about. Things that were going on.
Well, what did you think?
In my naivety, I thought that somebody knew more than I did, and they understood more than I did. And what right do I have to question? You know, I may disagree, or I may personally not want to be involved in that, but that's not my business. My business is to teach and to help people and to be involved with my friends, but I think that was the biggest thing is the feeling that somebody else knows more and there's a reason for what's happening.
But you wouldn't have known. I mean, was there an influx of refugees eventually that made you think that something very big was going on up there?
I knew about the rice drops. I knew about. I didn't see the refugees. That Fred talks about. I could have been just avoiding him. I don't know. But my world was different because of having a family and a young child. And
well, I mean, right now there's a Phoenix program operating in El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala, even though they just got this clean slate of Guatemala.
I'm involved in Guatemala. I know more now. That I know enough now to know I should have been horrified.
And
I've told Fred that, you know, that I really see now what he was talking about. But it's interesting to me to talk to people who had their friends killed, who knew firsthand, who saw the horrors of it, and who have dedicated their life to stopping it. And then I also see friends that accommodate their life to it and say, that's what war is, if you don't want to be a part of it. You shouldn't be there. And you do the best you can. And you cry, you know, over the tragedies, and you know both sides are doing terrible things. But I see it now as really horrifying, and that, I have to say, too, I started becoming aware of the lying when I lived in Laos, and Nixon was saying we're not bombing North Vietnam, and the planes were going over, you know, because we knew the planes were going out of the bases in Thailand. So I think little by little, I got to seeing the lies, but it's almost now a compulsion for me to when something is in the paper. Well, I wonder if this is something that really happened, mm-hmm. or if this is one of the things that was set up for us to shift to policy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's I can understand the complete total cynicism of people that mm-hmm. that throw up their hands at the whole thing and move wherever to get away from it. And I'm probably involved now more because I wasn't in the 60s. See, I was there 63 to 70. Mm-hmm. And when I came back here and started hearing about the plane shot down in Nicaragua, and the card on it was a friend from Laos right. that was doing rice drops. Uh-huh. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, because I knew in Laos that there was a joke about the hard rice and the regular rice, that the hard rice was weapons, mm-hmm. and that they were dropping in weapons, and it all wasn't rice, mm-hmm. the Food for Peace program it was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And when I saw that, I thought, uh-oh, I bet the same thing's going on in Nicaragua that mm-hmm. was in Laos. And, you
it
know,
was.
Sure enough, it was. Yes. Same group of guys,
same
the
people.
Same people.
Yeah.
And then I asked somebody who had been in a high position in Laos if he would, because he encouraged me. He said, instead of trying to figure out what was going on there, why don't you get involved in what's going on in Central America?
Right now.
Stop it
right.
from being repeated again, because
yes.
you can see it didn't work once. Why are they doing it again? And he told me that neighbors had said somebody's husband was a pilot that called and said, when you hear about the plane that was shot down, I want you to know it's not me. So he said, there's a lot of this going on. This isn't just one incident. You know, it should be followed through. So I got involved in that. Mm-hmm. And then I got involved in demonstrations against war in El Salvador. And I was arrested with a gang in L.A., and when they ask, it was real interesting because it was around Christmas time and it was the day when teachers were, the day was for teachers. It was Wednesday demonstrations weekly that were going on. And talking about the money going to El Salvador when we need it for schools here. Mm-hmm. And all the teachers that were there had kids from El Salvador in classrooms here that were talking about the conflict. And when we were arrested and handcuffed and we were put in a room together, it was Martin Sheen and Jackson Brown and Chris Christopherson and all these people, and they had the men around one side and the women around the other side, and they all went around to explain, you know, why they were here. And I said, well, you know, I'm here because I wasn't here in the 60s when people were doing this for Vietnam. And I couldn't have been. I was critical of the anti-war movement because I thought, well, they don't understand we're doing a lot of good things over there, too. Mm-hmm. Because, and I still tend to not be totally cynical, and I still, this is where I disagree with my friends, mm-hmm. A lot of friends, because I went back to Laos in 86, and I found there 7 former IVSers. I stayed with Mike Call, who was there with the UN High Commissioner on Refugees I'd known in Vietnam. I was with Jackie and Roger, who'd worked with the Quakers. Mm-hmm. Another couple with the Quakers mm-hmm. were there, who'd been another couple with UNICEF, who was IVS Bangladesh, and another couple from IVS were Food and Agriculture Organization. And we're sitting there talking about, you know, wouldn't it be nice if IVS could come back and work in Laos? Mm-hmm. And somebody said, well, why would they want us? Because we're just viewed as being part of the war and part of the whole military effort here. And then another person said, well, wait a minute, I don't think so. There wouldn't be this many of us here working now. Mm-hmm. And he said when they had the 10th anniversary, he said, you know, I think I know why IVS is here and IVSers are here working and can come back. Mm-hmm. One of the main Lao assistants is part of the government, one of the Lao IVS assistant coordinators mm-hmm. was in the government. And this is the 10-year celebration
right.
of the revolution.
Right.
And he said, you know, all the Lao that we worked with knew who we were
uh-huh.
and knew us as individuals and appreciated. And the thing that was so amazing going back, the interpreter that we had had learned English at Fong Oom School that was set up by the University of Hawaii. And I asked him, he was in the first graduating class. They developed curriculum using Lao language instead of French. Usually after fifth grade, they had to learn French and go to a French lycée, or learn English and go to English section at Don Do. And they set up a comprehensive high school that he was in the first class. He said, "You think my teacher would be upset that I've stayed and not left?" And I said, "Well, I don't know about your teacher, but I'm glad you're here because you're a wonderful interpreter for us." And he also was interpreting for the military, looking for MIA remains. He'd been trained in Hawaii. And now I just saw him again this year, and I saw him in New York. He was at the UN. He's now part of he's the deputy director of ASEAN. They're getting ready to join the Association of Southeast Asian Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, he explained that they use that model, you know, for the education system now, because it's practical. Lao language education that goes up to, I forget which grade, but they developed it as a comprehensive high school. So I know there were things that we were involved in and that we did that were beneficial. And in the old days, too, educated Lao didn't work with their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And now they have the kids going out working in the field. Everybody does, you know, cleanup. It was kind of a reverse from in the days when... And this struck me as very odd. In the days when they're capitalists, they're not a communist country, right? The government had lots of money. And people in government drove big cars. Anyone with an education didn't have to work with their hands. Going back in 86, it's just the opposite. Government people are starving. They don't have hardly any salary. And they all have businesses on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all scrambling, doing something, you know, to make some more money.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me as that they were more entrepreneurial and more capitalistic under communism than they were under the World Out government, because of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we saw a lot of things going on then that, you know, could really be supported. And it didn't seem to be... hard line, and since then I talked to Galen, and I showed slides then. I showed pictures from when I had visited, and he showed pictures from 10 years ago. People accused me of my slides being from before, because it was so hard for them to believe that things had opened up. This was 86 after it opened.
It's very common. Yeah.
It was hard for them to believe until they started going back
right.
And seeing it was okay to go back. And
yes, unfortunately, I was giving the same lecture. And there was a Vietnamese former officer who was in the audience. And he said, I have gone back, and I wasn't jailed, and nothing bad happened to me.
Uh-huh.
And you have to realize it's possible, whereas I had a student who, for 2 years, he just wouldn't believe me when I said he could go back to Vietnam. He's an American citizen anyway.
Yeah.
And he could go back to Vietnam anytime, and he would look at me and say, how is that
possible? And I kind of figured it was a psychological...
No, it's just indoctrination.
Indoctrination and also a justification of leaving this behind, and why would they be here if they could go back? I mean, they had to somehow justify, because I think it's been real traumatic for a lot of families adjusting and learning to live here, and probably it's partly that. But
well, picking up a thread, would we be right in saying that 69 meeting, that the famous Fred incident, is about the only real blip, a major blip during that period
for IVS?
Yeah. Because I'm trying to find some other event to hold a handle on, other than the individual groups that were going out and doing, you know, individual things. Was there any other kind of event we're missing? Maybe because we have knowledge of this, or we're spending time on it. Is there something else that might have happened, or anything that strikes you?
Before 70, there was a man who was evacuated, and I remember Al Basher as a board member coming. Al would have to tell you about it. He had a mental problem and was evacuated.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
See, I don't remember the meeting Fred was talking about and meeting Gardner. Mm-hmm. I wasn't involved. Mm-hmm. I may have met before then. I knew that I was not in favor of IVS leaving. I felt there was enough to be done in populated areas and urban areas, that they didn't have to be out in the boonies.
They could be withdrawn from those areas
and live and work in, you know, there's plenty of rural development, development even in the urban areas, even, you know, provincial urban areas. So I remember a meeting, and I think it was with Galen about that. That may have been the one that he wrote up all the notes to before Gardner came. But what I do remember was Alan Basher coming with another board member about the mental health problem. And,
This is the guy, Galen described this to me. This is the fellow who was, like, washing his shoes in the sink and just had extremely aberrant behavior. Is that what we're talking about?
I don't know.
Well, there's just
name
one sentence.
The person?
I don't know if he got around to giving me his name, but we're talking about the same thing.
He had to be taken home.
Yeah. And,
there may have been more than one. Because I know that one of the things Al and Dorothy, before they were divorced, were studying and were working on a questionnaire of trying to identify psychologically people who could cope versus people who couldn't in stressful situations. But I heard that this person had gone to Bangkok and met an Air Force pilot that talked about, I don't know if they're drinking together or what happened, about bombing over on the other side of the river, mm-hmm. and had the attitude that that was the enemy across the Mekong. And this guy said, no, that's where I'm living and working. Mm-hmm. You know, we're building bridges, we're digging wells, we're building roads over there. What do you mean? That's all enemy. And it freaked him out. It was the story I heard, that he was living and working where the Air Force thought it was enemy, and where it was open to bomb.
Right. And that's, Galen told the story of that village market being wiped out by a plane just looking for a target.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Val was involved in a case near Takek of people being killed along a river, and he took the Air Force people in actually to pay reparations to that area.
But that's when he's with USAID.
That was later, yeah. That's what I heard turned this person and just freaked him out. And then that he just couldn't, you know.
Well, it's something to think about. I mean, there was a Peace Corps person in Tonga who killed a woman, another Peace Corps volunteer. And was, I think, only by being declared insane did he avoid, you know, spending the rest of his life in Tonga, and was sent out of the country. But I think that happened significantly enough that one or two incidences out of 200 or 300 volunteers over a period of 10 years, but it'll be something to explore whether there was that kind of stress on individuals. But, you know, when you're looking at most of the volunteers who went, they're such stable individuals from very secure families, and they have chosen to go overseas, it seems. I mean, as you mentioned, you wanted to do the service, but you also wanted to travel.
Yeah.
And that theme comes up over and over again in all the interviews.
Yeah.
Yes, you didn't want to be drafted, but I did want to go to those kinds of places. I didn't want to risk my life, but I wasn't afraid of being in a dangerous area. It meant I could be there. In fact, that's what Fred said. But of course, anything can happen with the experience. I mean, nothing is ever what you think it's going to be.
Yeah.
And it may well be that that's worth exploring. Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up. Because, see, the problem now, as far as Laos is concerned, other than the growing visibility of the war in the north and the casualties amongst IVSers, there's no feature. You know, it's like there's a flat plane with a big meteor strike.
Yeah.
And there isn't anything else. And if something occurs to you later on, where you can provide perhaps a boulder here or a riverbank there.
Well, you know that Jim Lynn, the last director at IVS, died mysteriously. And
Oh, that's right.
And I think there'd been concern about him and what was happening there towards the end. Now, that was while, too bad you can't interview Tony, that was while he was director. Because I know
Tony was director of
IVS.
Tony
Lake
was director of IVS when?
At the end in 75.
In 75.
Yeah. When Jim Lynn came back, and I know he was very upset by, you know, whatever happened.
To Jim.
Yeah.
Well, you've just given me the only reason I can think of for Bill Clinton not being reelected president is that I could talk to Tony Lake as freely as I need to.
I know, yeah.
That's just a personal remark I'm over there. But, So Jim Lynn was the last chief of party in Laos.
I think so.
And he
was
killed
then? Now, some of the people back here suspiciously suicide. You know, it was suspicion that it was suicide. But I don't know details. Are you going to be seeing the Iresons in Oregon?
I'm
going
to try, yeah.
Yeah. Because they were in Laos when I went back in 86. And
you wouldn't happen to have their phone number, would you? Because all I have is their address.
I might have a phone number.
And the address has no phone number. And I emailed them. I have their email. But I'm no longer at my email.
Okay, I think I have a phone number.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah.
Let me just make a note of that so I don't forget to ask you that.
Because I feel like my experience was very limited and that I've really learned a lot from being with other people since.
Well, that's okay. I really want to know.
Yeah.